You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator, and it's your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host, and today we're going to talk about how a person transitions from one phase of their lives into another. And with me to have this discussion is my good friend and former student, Michael Clinton, who is also the former president and marketing director at Hearst Publications. Michael has recently written a book that helps roadmap how we can transition from one part of our lives into the new phase of our lives, and he calls his book Roar. You know, people who have spent a career, especially those in the for-profit space, have a lot to offer organizations in the nonprofit space. And people who've done almost anything have a lot to offer when they retire. You know, we're living longer. We have learned a lot more. We're engaging a lot more with different things. And there's no reason that a person shouldn't believe that when they retire, that they're not vital and that they have much to offer, particularly people who are trying to achieve social good. And we want to make sure, at least on this podcast, that everyone understands how critical it is to contribute, how important and how meaningful it can be to their lives when they give something back. And who wants to play golf all day, every day? Maybe you want to do that for a little bit, but there certainly will come a point in your life when you realize that you're maybe here to do something a bit more than that. And Michael is going to talk with us about how we can make all of that work, how we can get enjoyment out of our families, how we can get enjoyment out of our leisure, out of our recreation, but still set aside time and do it effectively and meaningfully, creating social good. So, Michael, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
Art, it's so great to be with you. Thank you for the invitation. Great to see you.
Well, it's been a while since we've had a chance to be together in person since your days at Columbia, and I had the good fortune of having you in my ethics in the nonprofit sector class. And what a great opportunity it was to get to know you and to see what some of your thoughts were about transitioning from the for-profit world, serious for-profit world, into the giving world, the world of service and giving. And I'll say you were really passionate about it as a student. And I can see that that passion continues, and we'll see how that plays out in this interview.
Thanks, Art. I should say with full disclosure that it was my favorite class of the 12 courses at Columbia. So, you know, I have a little bit of a special place in my heart for you and what you taught us and the conversations that you brought to the class. And it was a really great experience. So thank you.
I'm glad to hear it. And it was a great class. You had great students along with you too. It was a wonderful cohort. So Michael, you're out now. You're no longer in your role as a corporate executive. And now you are doing some things both for profit and also not for profit. And also written a book to help all of us think about how we transition from one career at one phase of our lives to another phase. And I certainly want to talk about that specifically as it relates to transitioning from for-profit to not-for-profit in our second or maybe third round of life. So let's get into it a little bit, Michael. First of all, give me a sense of what your orientation has been to working in for-profit and thinking about how you would get to nonprofit.
Well, you know, one of the things that was always built into my own value system was the notion of giving back in some form or another. It goes all the way back to high school and college, and I always carried that with me. And, you know, when you're younger and you're a younger professional, you know, oftentimes that's volunteering, you know, because you don't have a lot of money necessarily to become a donor. But over the years, through my for-profit job, I always integrated some level of nonprofit alliance. So I'll give you an example. When I was the publisher of GQ magazine, we started something called the GQ Clothing Collective, which ended up becoming the largest clothing drive in New York for homeless shelters. And we worked with the Volunteers of America New York, which was a nonprofit. And I ended up becoming on their board, and I ultimately became their chairman. So I got very engaged and involved, and it took me all the way through to their chairman's role. But every time I was doing something through business, aligning the brands that I was with to some kind of a nonprofit arm and venture. And I think people in the for-profit business can do that. You know, just think about your business and think about how you can integrate a layer of nonprofit engagement. One other example, at Hearst, where I was the president and publishing director of the company, we had a company-wide initiative that had all of our various magazines tie into some form of social purpose and giving that was expressed editorially and then engaged our readers to participate. So at Country Living Magazine, it was all about clean water and having, you know, the importance of clean water in communities. And, you know, in Marie Claire Magazine, it was about empowerment for women, primarily women in marginalized communities, and giving them tools, and the organization to give them tools to learn how to move forward in their lives. So always aligning with something in the nonprofit space in your for-profit job while you're in it.
Now, one of the things I had a chance to participate in was the Town and Country event, which you all hosted and brought together everybody's a serious philanthropist, but it brought together people who were looking at how they could improve and strengthen their philanthropic effectiveness in different ways. I always thought that was a really impressive event.
Yeah, thank you. We continue with that event. Obviously, in the last year, it was virtual, but we'll be live this fall. This is with Town and Country. We'll have the philanthropy issue in November. We'll have another event in October. I hope you'll come to it again. And, you know, we realize that philanthropy, especially for the affluent consumer, and this magazine targets the affluent market, is incredibly important. So we wanted to add a spotlight and enhance our commitment to philanthropy editorially. And, you know, so it's a really important initiative that we have as a magazine.
Yeah, and that demographic is really important, too. You know, most people now, we're seeing a decline, Michael, in the number of people, number of families giving to charitable organizations. But the wealthier people are sort of making up the slack for what people at the everyday level of giving aren't able to provide anymore. And we're trying to figure out why that is. But we really do need, you know, wealthier people to give to philanthropic organizations. And I had a chance to talk with a gentleman recently who also has written a book about the bottleneck at the higher end of our philanthropic scale. Many of the people, for instance, who've pledged to give away all of their wealth are finding it difficult to give at scale. And so they're actually making money faster than they can give it away. And he believes that there have to be solutions developed to try to figure that out. So anything we can do to work with that group to show them pathways to dispersing and distributing that money so that we can accomplish social good, I'm sure you would agree would be really important and helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two things on that. There, in the Washington Post on Sunday, I guess it was January 27th, I might have my date off, there was a great piece about the moral dilemma of the billionaire. And, you know, you may have seen the piece, and this is exactly the discussion. Because of the stock market and financial performances, you know, very wealthy people are earning significantly more monies. And, you know, while they're making contributions, they can make much bigger contributions. The dilemma we have is that, and you know this because we've discussed this, over the next 20 years, it's the largest transfer of generational wealth in the history of the world, $60 to $70 trillion worth of assets. And it goes down the pyramid from the billionaire status through those who've been fortunate enough to earn and invest and build assets. And what is the responsibility of this cohort, mostly baby boomers, 57 to 75, to put that money to work into creating social impact and resolving social issues? You know, this is the original activist group. You know, back in the 60s and 70s, they were marching against the war and supporting civil rights and women's rights and going to the Peace Corps, you know, celebrating Earth Day. And many would say that the boomers kind of lost their way. And now they have an opportunity to cement both their personal and generational legacy by going back to their activist roots and putting some of that money to work.
Yeah, well, it'll really be a great thing for them to really focus on that at this phase of their lives, given that they do have this tremendous wealth that they can distribute to social good organizations. And it's also incumbent on our organizations to make sure that we're ready to receive that wealth and to put it to good use. So we'll have to see how both of those come together. But I think anything we can do to keep that focus in front of everyone, that there's this great opportunity for us to maybe solve some problems that have been longstanding in our society. And it's the baby boomers who, in some cases, started a lot of this. It's their chance to maybe now finish it in a different way than they started it.
Yeah. So, you know, I would add to that, that for that next generation that's going to inherit the money, there are different ways that they want to be communicated to. There are different ways that they want to be engaged. And I think having, you know, initiatives and strategies to engage that next generation is really, really important. You know, I just read a report recently that, you know, while the boomers like very beautiful printed materials to talk about an organization's cause, the Gen X and millennials like communicating literally through text and through group chats and through other digital tools, and engaging them in that way, I think is really going to be important for future and for that transfer of wealth.
Yeah. So let's talk about the boomers for a minute, because you and I are both in that category. And I know for you, it's kind of an important piece of your life to have considered, what do you do when you're done one phase of your life and you move into another phase? So for those who are contemplating that, what are some of the tips and concepts that you share in your book, Roar into your next the next phase of your life? What are some of the tips and tricks that you share that you'd like to give us now, so that maybe some of those baby boomers can figure out how to get back into the philanthropic and cause-based game?
Yeah, no, thanks, Art. It's a great question. You know, the thesis of the book is that if you're 50 and healthy or 60 and healthy, you're going to have a really good shot of living to be 90 or older. And so this old construct of you were in your early 60s and you quote unquote retired, you know, that construct was created when life expectancies were 62, 63. So people retired, they lived a few years of sort of leisure life, and then they were gone. Well, all of that has changed, and all of that is changing dramatically. There are now more 65-plus-year-old people in the country than there are people under five. Every day, 10,000 people turn 65. One in five Americans will be 65 or older in 2030. And this group is rewriting the script. So in the book, you know, I interviewed 40 people. I call them they're the reimagineers. And these are the people who started nonprofit organizations in their 50s and 60s. These are the people who became engaged with a second career, where they may have had 40 years in one career, and now they're moving into the nonprofit sector as executive directors or presidents or CEOs and bringing their experience. So I think this amazing new period of life, you can start a nonprofit, you can move into the nonprofit sector as a leader in terms of, you know, bringing your skill set and have a 10-year run. One of the stories in the book is a man who had a long history of a business career, and he is 73. He's currently the executive director of the Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York. He started there as a board member. So one way to move into the nonprofit sector is to serve on a board. You know, I serve on three nonprofit boards. You get into the, pick the area that's of interest to you. You know, one of mine is higher education. So I'm on the board of Pace University in New York City. And when you get into the board, onto the board level, it leads you to various places where you may participate. Another example is a fellow in the book who I interviewed, who was a businessman, who was an entrepreneur, he owned his own company. He ended up getting on a higher ed commission in Tennessee through the governor, and was one of the co-authors of something called the Tennessee Promise, which every Tennessean can go to community college or trade school for free. And to make a very long story short, Randy Boyd is his name. At 60, only with an undergraduate degree, was asked to be the president of the University of Tennessee. And yeah, and he is now, he was an interim president. He's now the president, 5-year contract. He's paid $1 a year because he is, you know, does not need the money per se. But that route took him to an incredible new profession, which is the president of one of the largest university systems in the country. So being on a board, getting involved in a commission in your city, state, can take you down a path where you end up having, you know, making a significant impact. And of course, there are fundamental things like donor engagement and volunteering. And of course, I always also like to talk a lot about benefit corps and how a lot of the next generation, fastest growing cohort of entrepreneurs are people 55 to 64. That's a stat from the Kauffman Foundation in Kansas City. You and I both know John Tyler, who's there, one of their general counsel and chief ethics officer. But the social purpose business, the Benefit Corp, is really a very appealing way to mix business experience, because you can take a profit out of a social purpose, but more importantly, have a commitment to a social purpose, which is part of the business model. So those are just some of the various avenues and some of the people who I write about in the book.
Have you seen many nonprofits receptive to receiving folk from the for-profit sector onto their boards and different ways of volunteering and engaging with them?
Yeah, I think it's very much a trend that is happening. They're very interested in having business people. I'll give you an example. I'm on the board of the International Center of Photography in New York City. Photography is one of my passions. And during the pandemic, in the early days, when all museums were shut down and schools, we have a school as well, went virtual but had declining enrollment, it was a fellow who had been the CEO of J. Walter Thompson and I, who ended up becoming sort of executives in residence, helping the executive director manage his way through new territory that none of us had been through before. So Bob and I, we had our deep business experience, which allowed us to bring great value to the organization to get to the other side. And so that's just one example of how personally I was able to get engaged. But I think nonprofits are hungry for that experience and that wisdom.
So let's talk about your own volunteer efforts and some of the what you get from it, Michael, because I talk a lot on this podcast about service not being servitude. You know, we're not necessarily getting nothing from these experiences. We volunteer our time for sure. We give of our resources. But I also believe that we get things in return. What have you gotten in return? How has your volunteer life shaped the person that you are and added meaning to your life?
Well, one of the things about ROAR is an acronym. So R is reimagine your life before others do it for you. O is own all your stuff, your numbers, your financial numbers, your health numbers. A is the action plan. And the final R is reassess your relationships. And there's a whole chapter under that final R about reassess your community and your relationship with the community. And that's where this piece comes in, because I think that it is part of the human responsibility to be giving back in some way, shape, or form that is should be part of our social fabric and our individual responsibility. And as I said earlier, this has always been a part of me that was developed through my parents and through my family. And so the satisfaction that you get and the fulfillment that you get out of contributing in the way that you can, and I like to say, it's less about the financial contribution and it's more about the engagement. Because if you're engaged with an organization through one of their committees or their fundraising or their board, you really are then in the texture of their mission. And I think being a part of a mission about something you care about, whether it is climate change or social justice or, you know, human rights, that is an important part of fulfillment that I see. You know, one of the things, and you know this, Art, 12 years ago, some friends and I started a small foundation called Circle of Generosity. And our mission is to grant random acts of kindness to individuals and families that are sort of in a desperate moment. So just recently, we funded two families that lost everything in the fires in Boulder in Colorado. And just the reaction and the response, we do it anonymously. Just the reaction and response that this organization showed up and delivered a check to them was, you know, really incredible. Just before the pandemic, I was in a great trip to Ethiopia, and our guide was someone who we all became very friendly with and we stay in touch with. And he also texted me a couple of months ago that he was been devastated because of tourism and there's a civil war in Ethiopia and he's trying to find work so he doesn't have to go back to his village from Addis Ababa. And to make a long story short, we funded him to be able to get re-engaged as an Uber driver. Actually, they don't have Uber there, whatever the version is. But we funded him for him to buy into the car. He didn't buy the physical car, but the group, so to speak. And we were able to help him get back on his feet. So we give 1, 2, or 3 grants a month. So that's a really very fulfilling to be able to help someone when they're really in a tough, tough place. So I always say to people, find what it is that you're going to feel you're going to get fulfillment from, and that will bring you great, great satisfaction.
Well, Michael, one of the things I like to say about you is you have nonprofit cred. because you didn't just say, all right, I'm a corporate executive, I'm just going to go burst into the nonprofit scene. You actually went out and got an education. You got a master's degree in nonprofit management while you were working, I might add, which is equally impressive. And so when you talk to nonprofits, you know, you can talk from a base of not only your corporate experience, but what you've learned about the nonprofit sector through your education. And I think it is important for executives and people leaving the corporate world not to assume that everything they've learned in business is transferable and that there are certain things you should know. And you don't have to get a master's degree in order to know everything, but some training and education and orientation to how nonprofits work is probably helpful. What did you learn through the program that you went through that you would offer to others as, you know, this is a distinction. This is something that, you know, you're going to have to think about if you've been in corporate America for all your career and now you want to do some good work in nonprofits.
The coursework at Columbia was incredible. I loved every minute of it. One of the things I learned, and people in the for-profit world will relate to this, because the for-profit world, many, many sectors are being disrupted. And the nonprofit world is being disrupted in many ways. I mean, there are different kinds of philanthropists. There are different kinds of models. There's a different kind of scrutiny. There are so many different things that are happening. And I think, you know, certainly ethics, your course on ethics, you know, was a very big eye-opener, because in business, you don't necessarily think of all of these nuances that you have to think about in terms of nonprofit, making sure that there's no, you know, no conflicts of interest, you know, making just the various dimensions of engaging or overseeing a nonprofit organization. So I learned a lot about that. I learned a lot about disaster philanthropy, which was important for me in the foundation. I learned a lot about social purpose businesses, which I mentioned. And I think all of them have different pieces. And as you say, you don't have to get a master's degree, but I brought an enormous amount of the thinking to the nonprofit boards that I'm on in terms of integrating the importance of various things. Something as fundamental as, or wonky, I should say, as financing, and the fact that there are different kinds of social impact funds and different organizations that nonprofits can tap into. I took an amazing course on planned giving, and it really opened my eyes in terms of the different structures. In fact, I personally, through one of my philanthropic engagements, did a charitable gift annuity, which I knew nothing about. So I learned a lot about ways to donate and contribute in new formats and new ways. So it's a whole industry, and I think people in the for-profit world have to use their experience and wisdom, but be very open to the fact that it's also a whole separate world and industry, and you have to learn that sector, I should say, in all of its nuances.
Well, you know, I guess it's less true now that businesses are entirely focused on bottom line, right? So there are many different dimensions to corporate effectiveness too. And having a corporate executive, though, in a nonprofit organization will certainly help a nonprofit leader understand how best to work with businesses to achieve social good. Have you been able to identify some of the areas where maybe nonprofit leaders fail to connect well with businesses?
Good question. I think it depends on the leader. So leaders who come up through the programming ranks are not necessarily as experienced or knowledgeable about sort of general management, if you will. And part of that is how you engage with corporations in terms of potential funding, foundations of corporations in terms of potential funding. If you come up through the development ranks, you have a better sensibility about that. But I think that nonprofit leaders can do a better job engaging with businesses by understanding the business world on the flip side, and understanding what are the filters that companies use as part of their own ESG initiatives, et cetera, and part of their philanthropic initiatives. And so they can lean into that. So it wouldn't hurt for a head of a nonprofit to take some business courses. Once again, you don't have to do a master's, but there are lots of other ways to understand, you know, leadership, general management, fundraising. So it's the flip side of the for-profit learning about the nonprofit world. And I think that would be a good piece of advice.
Yeah, I just think that where there are opportunities in companies today, we're missing them, because so many businesses want to make philanthropic activity part of what they offer employees and what they offer customers to some extent, that we have to all do a better job, I think, understanding how we can help each other. And I'm hopeful that more will be done in the years ahead to bridge these two sectors in ways that we can see more effective outcomes for people and causes. I'm really hopeful that we'll learn how to work together more effectively.
You know, I would add one thing to that too, Art. My corporation has a foundation. It's called the Hearst Foundations, and it's actually a consolidation of what were a couple of foundations, hence the plural. And what is always amazing to me, it runs separate from the corporation, but what's amazing to me is how, I'll use the word sloppy. Many nonprofits are in engaging with corporate foundations. They don't follow up. They don't do the appropriate administrative paperwork. They don't do, you know, it's just sort of, you're not paying attention to the detail. And what happens is it can derail an organization for not only getting funding, but for getting future funding once they do get funding. And it's really the nonprofit's responsibility to make sure that they are fulfilling a corporation's, in this instance, foundation's requirements versus the other way around.
Well, I have to give a personal plug to the Hearst Foundations, because early in my career and throughout, that foundation has been very supportive of different things that I've been involved in. And I'll never forget, there was a woman who used to work at the foundation. She's now deceased. Eileen Mack. I don't know if you ever had a chance to meet Eileen.
I know the name.
But Eileen would come to your office and I would say, Eileen, you know, what do you need? What can we give you? And she would be very specific. Here's what I want you to do. Here's, you know, how you have to prepare these documents. And she was also very lenient. I mean, she, once they got a hold of you and they were connect and you were connected, you were going to stay in the grant making pipeline. They had a procedure where you would have a grant 2 years and then you'd have to be off a year.
Right. Right.
But then you'd come back and it would just be the way things was before. So it was always great dealing with that foundation. Even when I left to go to the Wise Giving Alliance, they funded the early days of the organization to get us to a point where we were mostly funded by our revenue streams and didn't need grants, but they were very supportive. They even supported, at my request, a grant to a school, a private school, so that kids from poor backgrounds could have scholarship money to attend that school. And we were able to get that scholarship program started through the generosity of the Hearst Foundation. And now, gosh, hundreds of kids have gone through that school, Germantown Academy, because of the Community Scholars Program that they helped launch. So I have a lot of good things to say about that foundation.
That's great.
And I'll look forward to re-engaging with them maybe this year and just getting to know people.
Yeah, no, great. Yeah, that's great to hear. You know, it's a very dynamic organization. It was, you know, we're a private company, or a corporation's a private corporation run by the trust of William Randolph Hearst. But many years ago, the foundations were established as part of the company's commitment to doing good. So thank you for that.
So, Michael, now here's the thing. You have gone ahead and decided that there's a big piece of your life left and that you've got to make some good with it. You're going to do some good with it. How do you really advise people? I mean, how do you say to someone, look, all right, you just retired from a company. There's a lot of good you can do. How do you get them going, Michael, so that they're not saying, look, I got tea times at, you know, 8 o'clock every day, cocktails at 3. Maybe I'm going to go hang out with my wife and some friends in the evening. And that's a great life. Nothing wrong with that, right? Except that there may be other opportunities for them to really do something substantial, something that will create a legacy for them. How do you not convince them, but how do you show them that that work can be equally enjoyable, compelling, and meaningful as what they're planning to do without thinking about those things that I'm just talking about?
Yeah, well, one of the chapters in the book Roar is called Life Layering, and how you can build, if let's call it a portfolio life. You know, it gets back to, if you're 60 and you're healthy and you're going to live another 30 years, playing the proverbial golf game and having drinks with your friends every day for 30 years is not going to be sustainable, right? You know, at a certain point, you're going to say to yourself, there's got to be more than this. And actually, I'm doing a lot of talks around the country, many Zoom, some in person, with high net worth individuals from various organizations. And this is a big dilemma for people in their 60s, because they do have this aha moment. And so what I say is, let's take out the leisure piece, which is, you know, your golf game or whatever you choose to do, and spending time with your family and your friends and your grandkids. Let's put that aside. That's table stakes.
Right.
You know, what are you going to do for yourself and for your life over the next 20 years? And I think that gets people starting to think. And a layer could be something like, I need to get my health and my fitness and my well-being on a better track. You know, that's one particular layer. Another layer could be that I want to launch an entrepreneurial business out of a passion that might be something I've always been interested in. But a significant layer would be this notion of, how do I get engaged in my community and giving back in my community in some way, shape, or form. The conversation I've had with a lot of people, because they'll say, where do I start? I always say, start with something that has meaning for you. And what is it in your life journey to this date has been something that has meaning for you? Has it been education? Has it been working within your local town, city government? Has it been climate change, as we talked earlier, or scholarship programs, as you suggest? Identify what has given you meaning and go deep into understanding that. And that, oftentimes, you'll land on an organization or a group that you want to get involved in a very fundamental way. Sometimes it may mean you may start your own thing. You know, one of the things that I love, one of the stories in the book, a woman who was a CFO for a company in upstate New York. She was very interested in helping children, young children who had college potential but didn't know how to get there. And she worked within, literally out of the, as she sat out of the back of her car, and she went to homeless shelters and community centers and family centers and found these kids. She created ultimately an organization called On Point, in which tens of thousands of kids in underprivileged communities, through her work, got on the path to get into college, get funding and scholarships to live a better life. And she literally, this was something that was core in her interest area, and she literally started in this very, very big grassroots kind of way. It now, by the way, I think employs 20, 25 people. It's a huge operating budget. And so pick the area that you are passionate about and think about your entry point going in.
Well, look, Michael, I really appreciate you spending this time with us today on the podcast. And I am just so amazed and impressed. I've been impressed by the man that you've been. And I am impressed equally by the man that you're planning to be over the next 25, 30 years. So it's just been great getting to know you and calling you a friend. And I just hope that we can stay connected and I can get to enjoy this amazing life that you're building for yourself, at least vicariously.
Thanks, Art. That's a wonderful comment, and I greatly appreciate it. And I think we're going to have a long friendship and have lots of, you know, great conversations in the future. And I'm always there to help you in any way, and I know you are in return. So it's been great to be with you.
Great. Well, you've been listening to the Heart of Giving podcast. My guest has been Michael Clinton, the author of Roar. You should go out and get that book, especially if you're thinking about the next 30 years of your life. You're at a transition point. This is a great book to help you with that transition. And for all of our listeners, if you want to hear other podcasts, you can find us on all major podcast platforms. And I would also suggest that if you want to support the podcast, you can do so by going to our website, give.org, and making a donation to the Wise Giving Alliance. Or you can also donate to us on patreon.com. Well, thank you for listening, and we look forward to connecting with you next week for a new episode.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's Terms of Service.